Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Well, today we've got a very special guest, and we do have to apologize for the little bit of delay that we've had. We are talking with my guest, Robert Boval. He is in Spain, and I am broadcasting Las Vegas, Nevada. And we're going to be talking today about a very special publication that he was very dedicated in producing. It's awesome as a read, and if you're a fan of Egyptian history, this is a must add to your library. The title of the book is The Egypt Code. Robert, I want to welcome you to the show.
Hi, Donna. It's a pleasure.
Well, I so am appreciative of your staying up. It's midnight. Actually, it's past midnight in your country, and I'm so grateful that you were willing to be up so late to do this interview live with us, and I know my audience appreciates your being here, too. Egypt has been a fascination for millions, millions of people for, my goodness, as far back as anybody can remember. The pyramids offer phenomenal mysteries. You yourself were born in Egypt. Is that the reason that you decided so much of your life to researching this phenomenal part of the world?
Well, partly, Donna. Yes, it's quite correct. I was born in Egypt a long time ago, in 1948. And I grew up there, and I left the country when I was 20 and went to live in Europe. I did my studies in England and qualified as an engineer, a construction engineer. I suppose Egypt and its antiquities were always at the back of my mind, but I never thought at the time that I would be writing books about this.
Okay, Robert, for some reason your telephone connection just disappeared. And your voice disappeared. So if you said, and you're not on a cell phone, so don't know what occurred, but the signal just totally dropped. I didn't hear the word you said. So could you repeat your response for me, for my audience?
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't know how much they heard. I was confirming that I was, in fact, yes, born in Egypt in 1948, and I left Egypt just before the 67 war, the Six-Day War, and went to settle in England, where I did my studies in engineering. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that it's always been at the back of my mind, the antiquities of Egypt. I'd seen the pyramids, of course, when I was a child, but I never thought I would write books about it. It came much later in my life. Is my voice coming through?
Excuse me. Yes, your voice is coming through fine right now. This is very good. And again, for those of you listening, Robert is in Spain, so we've been having some challenges with the telephone connections, but he's doing fine now. Robert, one of the things right at the very beginning of your book, which you thought was very well stated, there's still controversy about it, but you talk about...
Hello?
We're on the threshold of a new frontier. A new world is finally here. The guides are fast. And imagination, and love leads the way. We're on the verge of a new sensation.
Donna, and I'm so sorry. We've been having some technical problems, but I think we've probably got through it. Robert, thank you so very much for your patience. I appreciate that a great deal. Now,
it's
let's
okay,
go back.
No problem.
Let's go back because we were talking about the pre-Pharaonic culture, and you did quite a bit of research regarding this, and there was a culture you discovered that was ethnically Black Africans that were very similar to the Maasai of Kenya and the Dinka of Sudan. Tell us a little bit about how you made this discovery of these peoples that were far before the pharaohs as we know of them in our common knowledge, far before them. How did you discover that?
Let me just very briefly give the background to my work. As you probably know, Donna, My work started with a book called The Orion Mystery back in 94, and it was followed with a book I wrote with Graham Hancock, who's now in the States, by the way, titled The Message of the Sphinx. And The Egypt Code is my third book, which we mentioned just before we had the breakup. And now I'm about to publish a book called Black Genesis with an American physicist called Tom Brophy. And that's the book that speaks about this black culture, this prehistoric black culture. The story begins, in fact, not with me or Tom Brophy, but with a group of anthropologists from the United States, from the University of Texas, the Methodist University of Texas, who were exploring the Egyptian Sahara in the 1970s. And they were about 100 kilometers or so away from Abu Simbel, which is the most southerly town in Egypt, just next to the Sudanese border. They were about 100 kilometers in the desert, and they stopped to have what they politely called a comfort break, to have a pee. Mm-hmm. They were in four-wheel drives. And as they stood there in this wilderness, they noticed strange boulders all around that they very quickly realized were set in what was obviously an artificial way. Anyway, to cut a long story short, they discovered a site, a prehistoric site, which today we call Napta Playa. And it's a very, very unusual prehistoric site. I'm going to jump the gun a bit here because we lost a lot of time on the line.
Oh, don't worry. We're not going to cut your time off, so you go ahead and explain.
Okay. Well, this is back in 74, and it took a while for them to realize. In fact, strangely enough, it took them till 1998. The reason being is that they were anthropologists and they were looking for anthropological evidence, which they found. They found quite a lot. There was very strange structures there. Let me just explain this site. It contains the principal feature is a calendar circle, a sort of miniature Stonehenge. We call it the Stonehenge of the desert. It's not as large as Stonehenge. The blocks are much smaller. But it's rather important because they realized after carbon dating of some material they found around that calendar that it was at least 2,000 years before Stonehenge and a couple of thousand years before the pyramids. They were mystified because we never expected something like that to be found in the Sahara. Mm-hmm. In 1998, that is nearly 20 years after they discovered this site, they kind of had a hunch that it might prove to be some sort of astronomical contraption. And they brought an astronomer from Boulder, Colorado, a fellow called Kim Melville, who very, very quickly realized that this stone circle was in fact an astronomical circle. They found alignments to the solar alignments to the solstices and the equinoxes and so forth. And they published this very quickly, calling it the oldest astronomical site in the world. Came as a surprise to everybody, and of course it attracted my attention. As you know, my speciality is ancient Egyptian astronomy. And further investigation on this site very quickly brought to attention that the astronomy that they found related to this calendar circle, there was another structure next to it, which they labeled the complex structure. It's a kind of conglomeration of stones. Are we still on the air? Because I'm a bit worried that we're cut off.
No, we're fine.
Hello,
I'm just listening. I'm listening.
Ah, good. Okay, well, interrupt me when you want.
All right.
So they found that there was another structure which they called the complex structure A. And from this conglomeration of stone, a kind of very primitive stone temple, emanated like spokes from a bicycle wheel, lines, alignments of stones going about 500-600 meters, some of them going to the east, towards the eastern horizon, and some going to the northern horizon. Again, to cut a long story short, what they found is that the alignments were tracking a group of stars, which previously we thought was only the ancient Egyptians who did that. Now, the ancient Egyptians, thousands of years later, when they built the pyramid, their whole religion, their whole celestial religion was very focused on three constellations. One is the constellation of Orion. The other is the constellation of Canis Major, which contains the very bright star Sirius. And the third is a constellation in the north, which in the States you call the Big Dipper. We had always thought that this was original to the ancient Egyptians. And they built a whole religious system around it, and rebirth rituals and so forth. The pyramids, for example, are aligned to these stars. But here we had it in the desert, thousands of years before the pyramid builders, the very same astronomy. And very quickly we realized that what we thought was original to the pharaohs had occurred in the Sahara thousands of years before. But the funny thing about this Nabta Playa site is, although there was all this evidence of human presence and all these stone alignments and structures, no human bodies were found. And we had no idea who the people who built this structure, we knew they were thousands of years before the pharaohs, but who they were and how they looked like, we had no idea. Until we realized that they probably came, and this is where I step in with my colleague Tom Brophy, because our attention was drawn in 2007. Let me give the history, because it's important to understand the background to this.
Sure.
There is a region in the extreme southwest of Egypt. Now, the whole western part of Egypt is desert. In fact, Egypt is a giant desert bisected by the Nile. Were it not for the Nile, it would be a complete desert. The western desert, which we call the Egyptian Sahara, is a vast rectangular area, and in the extreme southwest, it butts against Libya and Sudan. Now, this region was totally unexplored till the 1920s. Nobody knew what was there. The reason being is that it's so far away, and it's approximately 800 kilometers from the Nile, in completely arid and waterless desert. Even today, to reach that region with four-wheel drives, you need about 6 days of traveling in the open desert, to give you an idea. So
Wow. Until
the 1920s, nobody knew it was there. It was discovered in 1923 by an Egyptian explorer. The first thing that they discovered was a mountain region, a small mountain region, which they called Uwainet. And there, when the explorer finally reached it, it was totally arid, completely uninhabited, so they thought. But they got the surprise of their lives, because while they were camping there, absolutely sure that nobody could have gone there before them, they were approached by a black African tribe, totally unknown, who spoke a totally mysterious language, and eventually they were able to communicate through sign language and so forth. And they were taken to see drawings in caves. And suddenly they realized that they were in an area that had been inhabited for thousands of years. The reason being is that those rock drawings were showing people, clearly of black African origin. They were very dark, very tall, looking like Maasai, and very sophisticated. They seemed to have domesticated cattle. They had houses. And strangely enough, many drawings showed fauna that could not possibly have existed in the desert, in the arid desert. It showed the giraffes and lions and elephants and ostriches and all sorts of faunas that today would be only found a couple of thousand kilometers further south.
Mm-hmm.
So the conclusion was quickly drawn when they reported this to the Royal Society in London, that this area must have been fertile in ancient times, and that now it's been arid for the last 5,000 years.
Right.
I decided to go and have a look, and I undertook an expedition there in 2008 with Tom Brophy. Let me tell you, it's quite an extraordinary place. We took off from Cairo, and we hit by roads. There's a tarmac road leading to the very last oasis, which is called Dakhla. And then from there, you shoot out in the open desert for 5 days, literally like in a sea of sands, to reach this remote area. Now, there are two mountain regions there. There is one called Wainat, the one I've just described, and there is a much larger one, which is approximately 300 kilometers long, and again, unknown until the 1920s. These places are totally unexplored. They've hardly been visited even today. And when we got there, it was very obvious to us that the people that we saw in the rock arts must have been the people that eventually went further east towards the Nile and had settled in this Napta Playa that I described earlier on, where we found all these astronomical sites. And now the connection is well established. We found the route that they took and so forth. The conclusion of anthropologists now is that we understand from climatologists that the this region of the world, this arid region, was once extremely fertile, approximately about 15,000 years ago. The reason being is that at the breaking of the last ice age, the monsoon rains from Central Africa would reach southern parts of Egypt and would drench this region and form artificial natural lakes, temporary lakes, that would last 5-6 months, and then the water would drain away into the soil.
Mm-hmm.
These people survived for thousands of years before the pharaohs because of these rains reaching there. And they had to adapt to the conditions as the climate began to be more and more arid and drier. They had to learn how to move vast distances and to time their arrival to these lakes that scattered all over this region. And because of that, they had to learn how to navigate. And that's how they learned their astronomy, thousands of years before the pharaohs. When the Sahara became super arid, about 3,500 years BC, they moved towards the Nile and settled there, bringing their cargo of knowledge, bringing their knowledge of domestication, the knowledge of astronomy, even knowledge of moving large stones, as we saw at Napta Playa, and injected all this in what became eventually the pharaonic civilization. So now we are pretty sure of the origins coming from a black African society that lived in prehistoric times in this western desert. They probably came originally from East Africa. We're now exploring this route to find their very source. But there is no doubt about it now that the pharaohs owe their civilization to a black African prehistoric civilization.
Amazing. You have so much fascinating information in your book that talks about various factors of Egyptian culture. And as the years go on and people like you are digging deeper and deeper into finds, like you have just described about Egypt, I was absolutely intrigued with a section. It's in the appendix of your book that I wanted to bring forward. It was called regicide, and I'd never heard of it before I saw your book. Not that it hasn't occurred, but the cultural aspect that you discovered about the ancient people and how they regarded their leaders and that they believe these leaders were man gods, which is not a big surprise. That was in Chinese culture and East Indian culture, and among the pharaohs, of course, they were considered divine. But it was modeled, you said, on a mythology who sacrificed, about the man god who would sacrifice himself willingly by being put to death for the benefit and prosperity of the people. That just absolutely was amazing to me. I mean, we all know about kings or people, you know, the regents that have been in a war, they've been killed. But the deliberate planning of that was just amazing. Now, how did you find out about the fact that this was a common practice? How many cultures did you discover that this existed in?
Well, it surprisingly was, in fact, a common practice in antiquity. We know even that Scottish kings were put to death willingly. But let me get on the Egyptian side of this regicide, this king-killing rituals. It's all based on a mythology, as you correctly pointed out. The theocracy of kingship in Egypt was modeled on what Egyptologists regard as a myth. The Egyptians themselves regarded it as a true story, a sort of Old Testament to them. And this myth is the Osirian myth, so-called Osirian myth. I'll narrate it very briefly. They believed that the gods had sent one of their own, called Osiris, who came from the sky and established civilization in Egypt. He took as his consort his sister Isis, and they formed the first pharaonic couple. The story goes that Osiris, in his prime, some narratives have him at the age of 28, strangely enough, roughly the age of Jesus, and was put to death by his jealous brother, the god Seth. And various versions of this story, but one of the most common version is that his body was cut into many pieces and scattered all over the land of Egypt. His wife, Isis, collected the pieces all around and regenerated him, she created, in fact, the first mummy. Mm-hmm. She was at the time childless, and in the myth we are told that she constructed an artificial phallus to become pregnant and take the seed of her resurrected husband. The husband, Osiris, departs in the sky, becomes a god in the sky, and joins the celestial pantheon as the constellation of Orion. She remains on Earth, and she gives birth to a son called Horus. This Horus king is the first of a lineage of pharaohs that believe themselves to be a reincarnated Horus. All pharaohs of Egypt regarded themselves as reincarnations of this Horus child, this Horus king.
Mm-hmm.
And when a king died, he underwent the same rituals. He was mummified like the original ancestor was mummified, like Osiris was mummified, and they believed that he would depart into the sky. Now, we understand that in very, very early times, probably in pre-dynastic times, before the establishment of a state in Egypt, the king willingly accepted to be put to death to undergo the ritual in its fullest sense. There is a ceremony, I suppose we can call it, which is known as the Hepset Festival. It's a kind of, presidential election that took place in ancient Egypt, where the pharaoh had to prove his virility, had to prove his strength, had to prove his sanity in order to renew his kingship. And should he fail, or should he be deemed not worthy of ruling, then he would willingly undergo a ritual death and assume that this death would eventually lead to a resurrection and a departure in the heavens like his ancestors. So this is the appendix that you have read. Now, Egyptologists, although suspect this occurred in pre-dynastic times, they believe that in dynastic times, this king-killing ritual stopped, and it was just enacted. So the king wasn't actually put to death, but in fact, they enacted a symbolic death. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit vague, really, as to what exactly happened. But they probably did put the king to death in very early times.
You also Hello? Go in... Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Very well.
Wonderful. All right. Now, Robert, you also talk about the cattle people and the stars. And this I found also fascinating. For those of you listening, I appreciate so much your patience because we had so many difficulties with the technical applications for the show. But we're talking with Robert Bovall, the Egypt Code, and he is the author of The Message of the Sphinx and the Orion Mystery, and he's coming out with a new book, which, Robert, I hope you'll send to me when it's out on
of course.
Bookshelves, because I would love to take this further. But the cattle people in the stars, you talk about the time when the Nile Valley in Egypt was very inhospitable. It was a marshland. It had mosquitoes. People got diseases. This was not a friendly environment. And, of course, it's almost hard to believe that the areas of Egypt that we now know and it's been for, what did you say, 5,000 years desert? It's hard to imagine that that was once so lush with life and water and trees and all kinds of growth. But who were the cattle people?
Okay, let me set up the scenario here. You've opened a very interesting topic. Climatic-wise, and we're talking something like 20,000 years ago, mm-hmm. The land of Egypt was a very different place than it is today. Now it's a very almost paradisical valley with lush, fertile lands and the gentle flowing Nile, and it's been like this for the last 5,000-6,000 years. A kind of paradise on earth, really. I grew up there, and it's really a wonderful place. But it wasn't so in prehistoric times. The reason being is that, like I was saying earlier, around something like 15,000 years, we had the breakup of the last ice age. Mm-hmm. And this breakup caused tremendous giant rains, giant monsoons, giant storms in Central Africa, which discharged into the lakes in Central Africa and would cause these giant floods to hit the what is today the Nile Valley. In other words, the whole place was totally marshland, was extremely uninhabitable. This was probably until 6,000-7,000 BC, perhaps a bit more. However, even though the Nile Valley was in such a dramatic state, the opposite was in the desert, which is now the desert. The desert at that time was fertile. It received the rains of this monsoon, as I described earlier. It was beautifully irrigated. There was pastoral land. There was lakes. As we can see from the rock drawings that I was describing earlier, the people had domesticated cattle. They seemed to be living in a wonderful setting. We even have them. They even left us drawings of them swimming in lakes. There's a famous cave of swimmers in that region I've described. I don't know if you've seen the film The English Patient, by any chance?
Yes.
Well, Lady Clayton dies in one of the caves in that area, the famous cave of swimmers. I've actually spent a night in the cave of swimmers in 2008. It's a fascinating place. Extraordinarily, they left us drawings of them of people swimming and playing and dancing and performing rituals. So clearly the whole Sahara in that western side of Egypt was very fertile and very hospitable. But the reverse happened. The reverse happened around 5000 BC, where the climate started getting warmer, the Nile Valley became more hospitable, the floods began to be more manageable, Egypt became the way it is today, while the desert suffered this aridity. It became drier and drier and drier. Now, who were these cattle people? Well, anthropologists have discovered at Nafta Playa, I've described the various structures that were there, but some of the structures are very, very mysterious. They found a conglomeration of what they thought were tombs, about 12 of them. They call them tumuli. They're kind of like flattened igloos made of gravel and slabs of stones. When they excavated some of them, expecting to find human remains, they were totally surprised that they found, instead of finding humans, they found cows buried in them. Fully formed cows in their full skeletons, obviously buried in ceremonial manner. There were artifacts laid around them. They were all laid in a certain direction. And we know from the drawings that we found further away in those regions in the southwest that they had domesticated cattle a long, long time ago. In fact, anthropologists believe that these people, these black prehistoric people, had domesticated cattle the very, very first time in history. We had thought that cattle was domesticated in Asia around 8000 BC, but the evidence in that region of Egypt throws the domestication of cattle 1,000 years earlier. So there we have these people who, for lack of better names, we've started calling them the cattle people. Mm-hmm. They clearly had domesticated cattle early. But when they finally, the reason, in fact, they probably domesticated cattle is that they had to move these vast distances. And instead of being hunter-gatherers and hunting their own food, they were obliged to take their food with them. In other words, the cattle became a kind of walking larders, the walking fridges, if you like.
Right.
And they had to learn how to keep the cattle. They had to learn how to move the cattle vast distances by navigating with the stars. So all this was developed slowly through these millennia. And eventually they settled in this region of Nafta Playa till finally they just had to move out because there was no more water, that the rain did not come anymore. And these cattle people moved with their cattle to the Nile Valley. Hence why we call them the cattle people. I began to call them the star people, by the way, because they were clearly very much into observation of stars. I should mention this before closing this point, is that the evidence we found at Nafta Playa wasn't just them observing stars and aligning stones towards star systems like Orion and Sirius and the Big Dipper, but they were actually tracking them over thousands of years. We have evidence of them tracking those stars over several centuries, perhaps millennia. This completely changes the picture of what we thought prehistoric people did, because tracking stars over that long period of time means that they were aware of the changing position of stars caused by a phenomenon we call precession. Now, this awareness of precession is attributed to the ancient Greeks sometime around the first century of our epoch. Mm-hmm. Whereas these people have shown us that they were doing the same thing, that they were aware of precession, that they were tracking stars thousands and thousands of years before anybody thought that ancient people did this. So we have this extremely sophisticated black African society living for thousands of years in the desert, having domesticated cattle much earlier than anybody else, having observed and formed calendars and learned about the movement of stars and able to navigate thousands of years before anybody else, and making their way with all this amazing knowledge these ingredients of civilization in the Nile Valley. So without them, there wouldn't have been the pharaonic civilization. And probably there wouldn't have been many other involvement in civilization. So we owe a lot to these people, whoever they were.
Absolutely. Now, in 2007, you had organized an expedition. I know we've got just a few minutes left here. Organized an expedition into the Egyptian Sahara, and you wanted to find, along with a friend of yours whose name was Mark Borda, you wanted to find the lost Persian army of Cambyses. And there is a chronicle by a Greek, Herodotus, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and there was an army that made up of 50,000 men, and this is just quite a visual when you think of it. It was overwhelmed. This entire army was overwhelmed by a freak sandstorm and completely engulfed by it. And they said there are waves, sandstorm waves, that are so high and so dense that this is something that can actually happen. Still going on in the desert? Do they still have these tsunami waves? You know, we watch the movie, The Mummy, and of course they depict something like this, and you go, oh yeah, this is Hollywood. But the truth is...
No, it's not Hollywood at all, let me tell you. I've been in desert storms many, many times. It's kind of spooky. The way you describe it is quite correct. It's like a tsunami of sand that can come from suddenly. In fact, sometimes these tsunamis hit the borders of Cairo, and they create quite a lot of havoc. In the open desert, they're much more dense, and it's extremely dangerous to be struck by one of these things. You really have to get shelter, and they can last for days, by the way. Let me just correct something that you said. In 2007, indeed, there was an expedition. It wasn't me. It was a Maltese businessman, a friend of mine called Mark Borda, who undertook an expedition with an Egyptian guide called Mahmoud Marai. You'll hear a lot about these people because they made an extraordinary discovery. There are two things that have fascinated desert explorers for the last century. One of them is finding the lost army of Cambyses, as you mentioned earlier. And it is a true story. It's reported by Herodotus. We know that there was a Persian army that decided to march foolishly into the desert to try and reach the oasis of Siwa, which is in the western desert, some 300 kilometers inland from the Mediterranean. I've been there many, many times. Beautiful oasis. They wanted to go there because there was a temple that they wanted to destroy for some reason. And they took off from Luxor in Upper Egypt, trying to cross the desert, a very foolish thing to do, because there's about 500 kilometers of open desert, totally arid. And with their bad luck, they were struck by one of these tsunamis. The army completely disappeared. We are not sure where, but probably some 100 kilometers radius from the oasis of Siwa, and many, many explorers have been trying to find it. There was a bit of a stir last year when a group of Italians thought they had found it, but it proved to be a false alarm. However, back to 2007, the two explorers, Mark Borda and Mahmoud Marai, went to the region of the southwest in this mountain region of Wainat. What they wanted to do was to see if they could find some more of this rock art that I've described earlier. And indeed, they have discovered several caves. It's quite extraordinary that caves are actually being discovered as I speak. I mean, it's an unexplored area. And when I went there in 2008, we actually discovered a cave ourselves with rock drawing. So it's there for the taking. Anyway, they went there and indeed discovered several of these rock art caves, but to their extreme surprise, they found, and before I say what they found, let me say what Egyptologists believed was the case, in ancient Egypt. Egyptologists, until 2007, were absolutely convinced that the pharaohs were not able to travel to these remote areas. For the reasons I've described earlier, they're extremely remote. It's almost impossible to reach them without today's technology, without four-wheel drives or going there by helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And their conclusion was, therefore, that the pharaohs never went to those regions.
Mm-hmm.
But the surprise came when Mahmoud Marai and Mark Borda stumbled on pharaonic inscriptions in Jebel Uweinat. And pharaonic inscriptions that date from the old kingdom, from the pyramid builders. They found evidence that the pharaohs of the pyramid age had actually gone there. And the inscriptions say that they, I've seen them myself, that's the reason why I went there in 2008. There is two lines of inscriptions that completely change everything we know about ancient Egypt. The pharaohs met their ancestors. They actually met this black African prehistoric people, and they very clearly knew each other, as if they had known each other before. It's a very strange conclusion now that we know that the pharaohs actually went to meet their ancestors. And what is more interesting as well is that they named the place, and they call it the Kingdom of Yam. Egyptologists thought that the Kingdom of Yam was, because they didn't think the pharaohs could travel there, was somewhere in the Sudan on the Nile. But now we know that this mystical Kingdom of Yam, which was run by these prehistoric black people, was somewhere in the southwestern desert, in these mountain regions. We now believe that they probably came originally from further south, in the mountains of the Chad. But that's another story which we'll have to talk in perhaps on another interview.
Well, I'll tell you, this has been wonderful, Robert. This book, The Egypt Code, is loaded with so much information, fascinating stories, details. We could talk for hours about this. And obviously, your life has been made very interesting because of your curiosity. And having been born and raised in Egypt, that gave you a perspective as well. What is the website where people can look up more information about your books and the Egypt Code, and also your brand new one that's going to be coming out?
Yes, this new one is called Black Genesis. My website is www.robertboval.co.uk. Now, I should emphasize, not .com. Unfortunately, my .com site has been hijacked and it's turned into some sort of bizarre pornographic site. I can't reclaim it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, it happened. So it's robertboval.co.uk. You'll find all the information there. And yes, I do would like to urge people to not just read the Egypt Code, but this forthcoming book, Black Genesis, because it isn't just a book that tells us about the pharaonic civilization and its origins, but it kind of puts straight, finally, that we owe a lot to black Africa. Civilization started in Central Africa, probably in East Africa. And now we know, because of all this evidence that's emerging, that it is black Africans who kicked off what is this magnificent pharaonic civilization. And to me, it gives a whole different image of who we are and who we owe a lot to. So to me, it's a very important book. I treat the Black Genesis as one of my most important books.
Wonderful. Robert, I appreciate your staying up until 1 o'clock in the morning your time in Spain. And I'm so grateful for your patience. We've had some problems with various aspects of technicality, but it's been a joy having you as a guest, and I look forward to having you again on the program.
It was a pleasure, Donna. It's always a pleasure.
Take care, and we'll be talking again in the future. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. When we come back, I'll have a few other things to share with you. Don't go away.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Well, I'll tell you, Robert is an absolutely fascinating man. I'm not going to open up the phone lines today because we just don't have very much time left. But I do want to let you know that we have got some terrific people coming on next week. We're going to be talking about Twilight of the Gods, Laughter, Tears, and Silence, and Ripley's Believe It or Not. I mean, we've got just such a tremendous lineup of guests next week. Now, if you want to find out who's coming up on the show, don't forget you can always go into bbsradio.com, Station 1, The Donna Sebo Show, and you'll find out a little bit of information about each and every guest that I feature. So be sure you do that so you know about the people that are going to be coming into play. Well, with the time that I have remaining, and again, I want to thank Seth and Dawn for trying their best. We were having so much of a challenge with phone lines, and you know, who knows, it could be sunspots. I have no clue. But what I wanted to do was express my appreciation to them because they worked so diligently trying to get the phone lines and technology to work together in harmony, and finally we were able to do it. And I want to thank those of you listening for having the patience to bear with us through all of this technical upheaval that we were experiencing. I will finish up this horoscope zodiac. We're going to be talking with Capricorns, Aquarians, and Pisces today. And that'll finish out the fall horoscope for 2010. Okay, Capricorns, what about romance and family? Well, you're going to be challenged. You've got a lot on your plate. You're going to have to balance time with family, friends, and work. You're going to wonder when you're ever going to have a chance to take a deep breath to get things done. But you know what? You're going to be able to manage it. And by the time the holidays start to roll around, you're going to have things pretty much in order, and they're going to be going smoothly. Now, when it comes to money for Capricorns, you are going to be moving into a new career environment. In fact, you're going to find that your finances are going to be pretty stable, and not only that, they seem to be growing. So you are going upwards and forwards in everything you do. If you're wanting to do some travel, just understand that there's going to be synchronistic happenings when it comes to the traveling opportunity. Take it when it comes. There's magic in it. For those of you born under the sign of Aquarian, you are going to be so focused on your family and friends during the fall. You just have so much social activity going on, and it's just absolutely a joy to you. You're going to say, this is what I have such a passion for. I'm just so delighted to be able to give my focus to those people that I love the most. New friendships coming in, too, as well. When it comes to money and career, you're going to be working and earning for every single penny you get. You're also going to be planning very diligently because you want to achieve some major moves forward in the year 2011. So planning at this time is going to be very important. Travel, you're going to find that travel isn't going to necessarily be your big focus, but you will be spending perhaps more time volunteering, being involved with activities of interest. It's like you really want to give some time to yourself and the things that you love. And then last but not least, let's go to those under the sign of Pisces. You're going to find your family life is just your total focus. But that's not unusual for you. But by golly, a little bit of love in your life is going to be shining, and you're going to enjoy every moment of it. Now, when it comes to money and career, you are going to find if you're hunting for a job, you must be persistent. Don't give up and don't get discouraged. This is the time for due diligence for those under the sign of Pisces. Also, if you're wanting to do some travel, well, figure out where it is you want to go. Make your plans now. You might get lucky and even win a trip in a contest or a lottery. You just don't know where your opportunities for traveling are going to come from. So have faith, keep looking, and don't drop the dreams. Well, this is Donna Siebel. I know we're just about out of time. Have an awesome weekend. I'm broadcasting from Las Vegas, Nevada, the city that never sleeps, and there's so much going on here. I hope one day you'll have an opportunity to visit. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Siebel. Take care, be well, and we'll be talking next week, live from the Pacific Northwest. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.